A beautiful woman found dead and mutilated at the waist. Who was behind such a disturbing, obscene crime? Who or what could she have possibly been involved with that would be capable of such carnage? Or was she in the wrong place at the wrong time? Today, we discuss the murder of Elizabeth Short, otherwise known as the Black Dahlia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Elizabeth Short, known posthumously as the Black Dahlia, was an American woman who was found murdered in the Limart Park neighborhood of Los Angeles, California. Her case became highly publicized due to the graphic nature of the crime, which included her corpse having been mutilated and but dissected at the waist. A native of Boston, Short spent her early life in Medford, Massachusetts and Florida before relocating to California, where her father lived. It's commonly held that Short was an aspiring actress, though she had no known acting credits or jobs during her time in Los Angeles. She would acquire the name of the Black Dahlia posthumously after the owner of a drugstore in Long Beach, California, told reporters that male customers had that name for her. The newspapers of the period often nicknamed particularly lurid crimes, a term they may have originated from the film noir murder mystery, The Blue Dahlia, released in April of 1946. After the discovery of her body on January 15, 1947, the Los Angeles Police Department began an extensive investigation that produced over 150 suspects, but yielded no arrests. Short's unsolved murder and the details surrounding it have had a lasting cultural intrigue, generating various theories and public speculation. Her life and death have been the basis of numerous books and films, and her murder is frequently cited as one of the most famous unsolved murders in American history, as well as one of the oldest unsolved cases in Los Angeles County. It has likewise been credited by historians as one of the first major crimes in post-World War II America to capture the national attention. The Dark Side of Wikipedia. My name is Tony Bruschi. Welcome to the program. Be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you are listening to us on. Today, obviously, we're discussing the Black Dahlia. Carol Hughes joining us to discuss the story of the Black Dahlia and what I know you know a bit about this one. Thoughts?
I have read a book about it.
Yeah.
But it was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched a documentary or two on it.
Uh-huh.
It's a fascinating story.
It is.
And I get why everyone became fascinated by it. And because here she wanted to be an actress, but what's really sad is what made her really famous was being brutally murdered.
Yeah. I'm not trying to be morbid or morbidly funny here, but the movies ended up being made about her. You know, obviously something in one way, that's good if it's about a good, happy, successful life. But if it's about your murder, it's not exactly the goal anybody sets out with when they're heading to Hollywood.
Exactly. Because I don't remember anything about her career.
No, she didn't really have.
Really, there was lack thereof.
Yeah, it didn't really take off ever. Yeah. But one of those, murdered, and who would have known what or if anything would have happened in that world? Because it sounds like there wasn't a whole lot of time spent there in order to get very far before it was all ripped away. Let's continue into the story of the Black Dahlia today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. Elizabeth Short was born on July 29, 1924 in Hyde Park section of Boston, Massachusetts, a third of five daughters to Cleo and Phoebe Mae Short. Around 1927, the Short family relocated to Portland, Maine. before settling in Medford, Massachusetts, a Boston suburb, the same year. This is where Short was raised and spent most of her life. Short's father built miniature golf courses until the 1929 stock market crash, when he lost most of his savings and the family became broke. In 1930, her father's car was found abandoned on the Charleston Bridge, and it was assumed that he had committed suicide by jumping into the Charles River. Believing her husband to be deceased, Short's mother moved with her five daughters to a small apartment in Medford and worked as a bookkeeper to support them. Troubled by bronchitis and severe asthma attacks, Short underwent lung surgery at age 15, after which doctors suggested she relocate to a milder climate during the winter months to prevent further respiratory problems. Short's mother then sent her to spend winters in Miami with family and friends. During the next 3 years, Short lived in Florida during the winter months and spent the rest of the year in Medford with her mother and sisters. In her sophomore year, Short dropped out of the Medford High School. In late 1942, Short's mother received a letter of apology from her presumed deceased husband, which revealed that he was in fact alive and had started a new life in California. In December, at age 18, Short relocated to the Valley to live with her father, whom she had not seen since she was 6 years old. At the time, he was working at a nearby Mare Island Naval Shipyard in San Francisco Bay. Arguments between Short and her father led to her moving out in January of 1943. Shortly after, she took a job at the base exchange at Camp Cook, now Vandenberg Air Force Base, near Lompoc, living with several friends and briefly with an Army Air Force sergeant who reportedly abused her. Short left Lompoc in mid-1943 and moved to Santa Barbara, where she was arrested on September 23, 1943, for underage drinking at a local bar. The juvenile authority sent her back to Medford, but she returned instead to Florida, making only occasional visits to Massachusetts. When in Florida, Short met Major Matthew Michael Gordon Jr., a decorated Army Air Force officer at the 2nd Air Commando Group. He was training for deployment to the China-Burma-India Theater of Operations of World War II. Short told friends that Gordon had written to propose marriage while he was recovering from injuries from a plane crash in India. She accepted his offer, but Gordon died in a second crash on August 10, 1945, less than a week before the surrender of Japan ended the war. She relocated to Los Angeles in July 1946 to visit Army Air Force Lieutenant Joseph Gordon Fickling, whom she had known from Florida. Fickling was stationed at the Naval Reserve Base in Long Beach. Short spent the last 6 months of her life in Southern California, mostly in the Los Angeles area. Shortly before her death, she had been working as a waitress and rented a room behind the Florentine Gardens nightclub on Hollywood Boulevard. Short has been voraciously described and depicted as an aspiring or would-be actress. According to some sources, she did in fact have aspirations to be a film star, though she had no acting jobs or credits. Then on January 9, 1947, Short returned to her home in Los Angeles after a brief trip to San Diego with Robert Red Manley, 25-year-old married salesman she had been dating. Manley stated that he dropped Short off at the Biltmore Hotel, located at 506 Southern Grand Avenue in downtown Los Angeles, and that Short was to meet her sister, who was visiting from Boston that afternoon. By some accounts, staff at the Biltmore recalled having seen Short using the lobby telephone. Shortly after, she was alleged seen by patrons of the Crown Grill Cocktail Lounge at 754 South Olive Street, approximately 0.4 miles away from the Biltmore Hotel. On the morning of January 15, 1947, Short's naked body was found severed in two pieces on a vacant lot on the west side of South Norton Avenue, midway between Coliseum Street and West 39th Street in Limont Park, Los Angeles. At the time, the neighborhood was largely undeveloped. Local resident Betty Bershinglinger discovered the body at approximately 10 a.m. while walking her 3-year-old daughter. Bershinger initially thought she had found a discarded store mannequin. When she realized it was a corpse, she rushed to a nearby house and telephoned the police. Short's severely mutilated body was completely severed at the waist and drained of blood, leaving her skin a paled white. Medical examiners determined that she had been dead for around 10 hours prior to the discovery. leaving her time of death either sometime during the evening of January 14th or the early morning hours of January 15th. The body had apparently been washed by the killer. Short's face had been slashed from the corners of her mouth to her ears, creating an effect known as the Glasgow smile. She had several cuts on her thigh and breasts where entire portions of flesh had been sliced away. The lower half of her body was positioned a foot away from the upper, and her intestines had been tucked neatly beneath her buttocks. The corpse had been posed with her hands over her head, her elbows bent at right angles and her legs spread apart. Upon the discovery, a crowd of both passerby and reporters began to gather. Los Angeles Herald Express reporter Aggie Underwood was among the first to arrive at the scene and took several photos of the corpse and crime scene. Near the body, detectives located a heel print on the ground amid the tire tracks, and a cement stack containing watery blood was also found nearby. An autopsy of Short's body was performed on January 16, 1947, by Frederick Newbar, the Los Angeles County coroner. Newbar's autopsy report stated that Short was 5 feet 5 inches tall, weighed 115 pounds, and had light blue eyes, brown hair, and badly decayed teeth. There were ligature marks on her ankles, wrists, and neck, and an irregular laceration with superficial tissue loss on her right breast. Newbar also noted superficial lacerations on the right forearm, upper right arm, and the lower left side of the chest. Short's official Los Angeles County death certificate was issued in 1947. The body had been cut completely in half by a technique taught in the 1930s called a hemicropterectomy. The lower half of her body had been removed by transecting the lumbar spine between the second and third lumbar vertebrae, thus severing the intestine at the demodenum. Newbar's report noted very little bruising among the incision lines, suggesting it had been performed after death. Another gaping laceration measuring 4.25 inches in length ran longitudinally from the umbilicus to the other regions. The lacerations on each side of the face, which extended from the corners of the lips, were measured at 3 inches on the right side of her face and 2.5 inches on the left. The skull was not fractured, but there was bruising noted on the front and right side of her scalp with a small amount of bleeding on her right side, consistent with blows to the head. The cause of death was determined to be hemorrhaging from the lacerations to her face and the shock from blows to the head and face. Newbar noted that Short's anal canal was dilated at 1.75 inches, suggesting she may have been raped. Samples were taken from her body, testing for the presence of sperm, but the results came back negative. Prior to the autopsy, police had quickly been able to identify the victim as Short after sending copies of her fingerprints to Washington, D.C. via sound photo, a primitive fax machine of the era. The prints matched those given by Short during the 1943 arrest. Immediately following Short's identification, reports from William Randolph Hearst's Los Angeles Examiner contacted her mother, Phoebe Short, in Boston, and told her that her daughter had won a beauty contest. It was only after prying as much personal information as they could from Phoebe that the reporters revealed that their daughter had in fact been murdered. The newspaper offered to pay her airfare and accommodations if she would travel to Los Angeles to help them with the police investigation. That was yet another ploy, since the newspaper kept her away from police and other reporters to protect its scoop. The Examiner and another Hearst newspaper, the Los Angeles Herald Express, later sensationalized the case, with one article from the Examiner describing the black tailored suit Short had last seen wearing as a tight skirt and a sheer blouse. A media nicknamed her the Black Dahlia and described her as an adventuress who prowled Hollywood Boulevard. Additional newspaper reports, such as one published in the Los Angeles Times on January 17th, deemed the murder a sex fiend slaying. So now that we know every detail of every laceration and anal dilation, we can now continue to discuss what exactly happened to Ms. Short.
Did not know about the way they treated her family.
No.
Like, that is sick to call the mom and say, oh yeah, your daughter won a beauty contest. And so the mom would be all excited.
Yeah.
And then go, oh yeah, about that.
By the way, she's dead. That is fucking insane. I mean,
you know, back then it was very competitive.
Yeah.
And ruthless, obviously, they did that. And just didn't even care about... And then it was like, oh, yeah, she's murdered. But we'll fly you out here.
Could you imagine if that happened today? Oh, my God. It would just be insane.
That is horrible.
That's like Jerry Springer shit, but worse.
Oh, God, yeah. It's not like, and you're the father. It's like, and as the mother, you have a murdered daughter.
Oh, my God. And you're just sitting there, you're on the phone, and you're like, hey, you know, your daughter won a beauty contest. She's, you know, so great. And okay, now that we kind of got, yeah, you know, it isn't, okay.
We have all the details we want from you.
Oh, my God.
That's just a sick way to get the information they wanted.
Yeah. That is messed up. Well, let's continue into the investigation portion of this story and see what other pieces come together. I always enjoy these articles because I end up learning much more than I've learned from all the documentaries I've watched over the years. So let's continue on into the investigation. On January 21st, 1947, a person claiming to be Short's killer placed a phone call to the office of James Richardson, the editor of the Examiner, congratulating Richardson on the newspaper's coverage of the case and stated he planned on eventually turning himself in, but not before allowing police to pursue him further. Additionally, he told Richardson to expect some souvenirs of Beth Short in the mail. On January 24th, a suspicious manila envelope was discovered by U.S. Postal Service worker. The envelope had been addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner and other Los Angeles papers with individual words that had been cut and pasted from newspaper clippings. Additionally, a large message on the face of the envelope read, "Here is Dahlia's belongings. Letter to follow." The envelope contained Short's birth certificate, business cards, photographs, names written on pieces of paper, and an address book with the name Mark Hansen embossed on the cover. The packet had been carefully cleaned with gasoline, similarly to Short's body, which led police to suspect the packet had been sent directly by the killer. Despite the efforts to clean the packet, several partial fingerprints were lifted from the envelope and sent to the Federal Bureau of Investigation for testing. However, the prints were compromised in transit and thus could not be properly analyzed. The same day the packet was received by the Examiner, a handbag and the black suede shoe were reported to have been sent on top of a garbage can in an alley a short distance from Norton Avenue, 2 miles from where Short's body had been discovered. The items were recovered by police, but they'd been also wiped clean with gasoline, destroying any fingerprints. On March 14th, an apparent suicide note scrawled in pencil and a bit of paper was found tucked in a shoe in a pile of men's clothing by the ocean's edge at the foot of Breeze Avenue, Venice. The note read, "To whom it may concern, I have waited for the police to capture me for the Black Dahlia killing, but have not. I'm too much of a coward to turn myself in, so this is the best way out for me. I couldn't help myself for that or this. Sorry, Mary." A pile of clothing was first seen by the beach caretaker who reported the discovery to John Dillon, lifeguard captain. Dillon immediately notified Captain L.E. Christensen of West Los Angeles Police Station. The clothes included a coat and trousers of blue herringbone tweed, a brown and white Y shirt with white jockey shorts, tan socks, and tan moccasin leisure shoes, size about 8. The clothes gave no clue about the identity of their owner. Police quickly deemed Mark Hansen, the owner of the address book found in the packet, a suspect. Hansen was a wealthy local nightclub and theater owner and an acquaintance at whose home Short had stayed with friends. And according to some sources, he also confirmed that the purse and shoe discovered in the alley were in fact Short's. Ann Toth, Short's friend and roommate, told investigators that Short had recently rejected sexual advances from Hansen and suggested as potential cause for him to kill her. However, he was cleared of suspicion in the case. In addition to Hansen, the Los Angeles Police Department interviewed over 150 men in the ensuing weeks whom they believed to be potential suspects. Manley, who had been one of the last people to see Short alive, was also investigated but was cleared of suspicion after passing numerous polygraph examinations. Police also interviewed several persons found listed in Hansen's address book, including Martin Lewis, who had been an acquaintance of Short's. Lewis was able to provide an alibi for the date of Short's murder, as he was in Portland, Oregon, visiting his father-in-law, who was dying of kidney failure. A total of 750 investigators from the LAPD and other departments worked on this case during its initial stages, including 400 sheriff's deputies, 250 California State Patrol officers. Various locations were searched for potential evidence, including storm drains throughout Los Angeles, abandoned structures, and various sites along the Los Angeles River. But the searches yielded no further evidence. City Councilman Lloyd G. Davis posted a $10,000 reward for information leading to Short's killer. After the announcement of the reward, various persons came forward with confessions, most of which police dismissed as false. Several of the false confessors were charged with obstruction of justice. On January 26, another letter was received by the Examiner, this time handwritten, which read, "Here it is, turning in Wednesday, January 29th, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. Black Dahlia Avenger." The letter also named a location at which the supposed killer would turn himself in. Police waited at the location on the morning of January 29th, but the alleged killer did not appear. Instead, at 1 p.m., the Examiner offices received another cut-and-pasted letter which read, "Have changed my mind. You'd not give me a square deal. Dahlia killing was justified." The graphic nature of the crime and the subsequent letters received by the Examiner had resulted in a media frenzy surrounding Short's murder. Both local and national publications covered the story heavily, many of which reprinted sensationalistic reports suggesting that Short had been tortured for hours prior to her death. The information, however, was false, yet police allowed the reports to circulate as to conceal Short's true case of death, cerebral hemorrhage from the public. Further reports about Short's personal life were publicized, including details about her alleged declining of Hansen's romantic advances. Additionally, a stripper who was an acquaintance of Short's told police that she had liked to get guys worked up over her, but she'd leave them hanging dry. This led some reporters, namely Herald Express Bevo Means and detectives, to look into the possibility that Short was a lesbian and begin questioning employees and patrons of gay bars in Los Angeles. This claim, however, remained unsubstantiated. The Herald Express also received several letters from the purported killer, again made with cut-and-paste clippings, one of which read, "I will give up on Dahlia killing if I get 10 years. Don't try to find me." On February 1st, the Los Angeles Daily News reported that the case had run into a stone wall with no new leads for investigators to pursue. The Examiner continued to run stories on the murder and the investigation, which was front-page news for 35 days following the discovery of the body. When interviewed, lead investigator Captain Jack Donahue told the press that he believed Short's murder had taken place in a remote building or shack on the outskirts of Los Angeles, and her body transported into the city where it was disposed of. Based on the precise cuts and dissection of Short's corpse, the LAPD looked into the possibility that the murder may have been a surgeon, doctor, or someone with medical knowledge. In mid-February 1947, the LAPD served a warrant to the University of Southern California Medical School, which was located near the site where Short's body had been discovered, requesting a complete list of the program's students. The university agreed so long as the student identities remained private. Background checks were conducted, but they yielded no results. And it just keeps going and going, and everybody's trying to figure out the answers here. What I found kind of amusing in that piece was, well, the fact that she was rejecting these men's advances, she must be a lesbian.
Of course. It's like, why else?
What else would there possibly be? Maybe she's not interested in you. You ever think of that one? I mean, but it seems like such a man thing of, like Mad Men era type thing to do, where it's like, well, that's the only possible explanation. Who could resist me?
Well, and then once again, they're basically slut shaming her at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, she dated this guy and this guy and this guy. And then, so they're kind of victimizing the victim
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Well, all these investigators, all these men who are investigating, they can't come up with their answer as to what the hell happened. So what's the next thing you do? Well, discredit the whole fucking thing. You know, well, she's a whore. She's a, you know, she kind of got around. She's friends with a stripper. Maybe she's a lesbian. You know, let's throw shade, or what they viewed as shade at the time, you know, that direction. And because we clearly can't figure this shit out. So if everybody kind of doesn't care because we lowered her status in society, in terms of how people view her, to being less of a person, with these labels, then maybe it'll go away and we won't be so pressured to try and figure this shit out. That's my guess, is kind of how that was being played.
Oh yeah. And you know, I mean, just from the facts of how she was killed really says a lot about who could have done it.
Yeah.
And I think nowadays, you know, there are people who really are experts in that kind of thing. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but you know, the psychology behind it, like we're looking for someone, because I was watching a show just the other night and the person, they kind of profiled him. They're like, we're looking for this kind of person.
Yeah.
And it was in that show. I think we did the show on it.
Evil Genius?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they profiled like Porter.
Yep.
This. And that was pretty much who they found.
Yeah, they demographically broke it down pretty damn well.
In this case, it's pretty obvious someone had to have known how to do what they did with her body.
Yeah.
You wouldn't just randomly do that.
There's no random person
showing off your expertise at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many clues right there, but these investigators are saying, they're going, maybe she's a lesbian. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, what? I mean,
like, there's 700 people, men, investigating this case.
Yeah.
They don't have computers or anything. I guess somebody has some master file on it. Like, how do you even organize 700 people investigating one person's murder? I don't even get that.
I have no idea. It's like how you could do, I mean, that's why you have software today for that. But 700 people? I mean,
like, how would you have organized the information?
Yeah. And then, to know who has what or doesn't have, I have no idea. But that's, gosh. It's shocking to look back at some of these things, because yes, it's a big mystery. There's so many weird things about it, but if you could just jump back in time for 5 minutes and go, turn your direction this way, look over here. I don't have the answer, but I think the answer may be over there. Why didn't you go that way more? Why did you stop there? You know, unless there's some, you know, some shady shit going down and somebody somewhere is involved and they're helping to steer where an investigation goes.
I mean, her blood was drained from her body.
Yeah.
You know, that just doesn't happen. You bleed, but having it drained from your body is a totally different thing.
Yeah. That's something you only learn today if you subscribe to Masterclass. Masterclass now has classes on how to drain blood from bodies. You can sign up right now and I'm kidding. It's not a commercial.
Somebody out there was like, oh my God, I want to do that.
It's right after the How to Barbecue Like a King series. It's right after that. And some parts are actually kind of interspliced between the two, which is kind of uncomfortable and weird when you're talking about brisket and then how to drain a body of blood in the next video. It just doesn't flow well. But let's continue in here to the story of the Black Dahlia and see exactly where this all continues to lead us. By the spring of 1947, Short's murder had become a cold case with few new leads. Sergeant Finnis Brown, one of the lead detectives on the case, blamed the press for compromising the investigation through reporters' probing of details and unverified reporting. In September of 1949, a grand jury convened to discuss inadequacies in the LAPD's homicide unit based on their failure to solve numerous murders, especially those of women and children. In the past several years, Short's being one of them. In the aftermath of the grand jury, further investigation was done on Short's past, with detectives tracing her movements between Massachusetts, California, and Florida, and also interviewed people who knew her in Texas and New Orleans. However, the interviews yielded no useful information to the murder, suspects, and confessions. The notoriety of Short's murder had spurred a large number of confessions over the years, many of which had been deemed false. During the initial investigation into her murder, police received a total of 60 confessions, most made by men. Since that time, over 500 people have confessed to the crime, some of whom had not even been born at the time of her death. Sergeant John P. St. John, a detective who worked the case until his retirement, stated, "It's amazing how many people offer up a relative as a killer." In 2003, Ralph Estelle, one of the original detectives in the case, told the Times that he believed he had interviewed Short's killer, a man who had been seen with his sedan parked near a vacant lot where her body was discovered, in the early morning hours of January 15, 1947. A neighbor driving by that day stopped to dispose of a bag of lawn clippings in the vacant lot when he saw a parked sedan, allegedly, with its right rear door open. The driver of the sedan was standing in the lot. His arrival apparently startled the owner of the sedan, who approached his car and peered in the window before returning to the sedan and driving away. The owner of the sedan was followed to a local restaurant where he worked, but was ultimately cleared of suspicion. Suspects remained under discussion by various authors and experts, including a doctor named Walter Bailey, proposed by the former Times copy editor Larry Harnish, Times publisher Norman Chandler, whom biographer Donald Wolfe claims impregnated Short, Leslie Dillon, Joseph A. Dumas, Artie Lang, a.k.a. Jeff Connors, Mark Hansen, Francis E. Sweeney, Woody Guthrie, Bugsy Siegel, Orson Welles, George Hodel, Hodel's friend Fred Sexton, George Knowlton, Robert M. Red Manley, Patrick S. O'Reilly, and Jack Anderson Wilson. Police came to consider George Hill Holder Jr. a suspect after the 1947 murder of Elizabeth Short. He was never formally charged with the crime and came to wider attention as a suspect after his death when he was accused by his son, Los Angeles homicide detective Steve Hodel, of killing Short and committing several additional murders. Prior to the Dahlia case, he was also a suspect in the death of his secretary, Ruth Spaulding, but was not charged and was accused of raping his own daughter, Tamar, but acquitted. He fled the country several times and spent 1950 to 1990 in the Philippines. Several crime authorities, as well as Cleveland detective Peter Marlowe, have suspected a link between the Short murder and the Cleveland torso murders, which took place in Cleveland, Ohio, between 1934 and 1938. As part of their investigation into the murders that took place before and after the Short killing, the original LAPD investigators studied the torso murders in 1947, but later discounted any relationship between the two cases. In 1980, new evidence implicating a former torso murder suspect, Jack Anderson Wilson, a.k.a. Arnold Smith, was investigated by Detective St. John in relation to Short's murder. He claimed he was close to arresting Wilson for Short's murder, but that Wilson died in a fire on February 4th of 1982. The possible connection between Short's murder and the torso murders received renewed media attention when it was profiled on the NBC series Unsolved Mysteries in 1992, in which Elliot Ness biographer Oscar Fraley suggested Ness knew the identity of the killer responsible for both cases. The February 10, 1947 murder of Janine French in Los Angeles was also considered by the media and detectives as possibly being connected to Short's killing. French's body was discovered in West Los Angeles on Grandview Boulevard, nude and badly beaten. Written on her stomach in lipstick was what appeared to say, "Fuck you, BD," and the letters TEX below. The Herald Express covered the story heavily and drew comparisons to the Short murder less than a month prior, surmising the initials BD to stand for Black Dahlia. According to historian John Lewis, however, the scrawling actually read PD, obstinately standing for Police Department. Crime authorities such as Steve Hodel and William Rasmussen have suggested a link between the Short murder and the 1946 murder and dismemberment of 6-year-old Suzanne Dengen in Chicago, Illinois. Captain Donahue of the LAPD stated publicly that he believed the Black Dahlia and the Chicago lipstick murders were likely connected. Among the evidence cited in the fact that Short's body was found on Norton Avenue, 3 blocks west of Dengen Boulevard, Dengen being the last name of the girl from Chicago. There were also striking similarities between the handwriting of the Dengen ransom note and that of the Black Dahlia Avenger. Both texts used a combination of capitals and small letters. And both notes contain a similar misshapen letter P. And if one word that matches exactly. Convicted serial killer William Heron served life in prison for Dengen's murder. Initially arrested at 17 for breaking into a residence close to that of Dengen, Heron claimed he was tortured by police, forced to confess, and made a scapegoat for the murder. After being taken from the medical infirmary at the Dixon Correctional Center on February 26, 2012 for health problems, Heron died at the University of Illinois Medical Center on March 5, 2012 at 83. Additionally, Steve Hodell has implicated his father, George Hodell, as Short's killer, citing his father's training as a surgeon as circumstantial evidence. In 2003, it was revealed in notes from the 1949 grand jury report that investigators had wiretapped Hodell's home and obtained recorded conversations of him with an unidentified visitor saying, "Suppose that I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary because she's dead." In 1991, Janice Knowlton, a woman who was 10 years old at the time of Short's murder, claimed that she witnessed her father, George Knowlton, beat Short to death with a claw hammer in the detached garage of her family's home in Westminster. She also published a book titled Daddy Was the Black Dahlia Killer in 1995, in which she made additional claims that her father sexually molested her. The book was condemned as trash by Knowlton's stepsister, Jolene Emerson, in 2004, who stated, "She believed it, but it wasn't reality. I know because I lived with her father for 16 years. Additionally, Detective St. John told the Times that Knowlton's claims were not consistent with the facts of the case. Don Gilmore's 1994 book, Severed, The True Story of the Black Dahlia Murder, suggested a possible connection between Short's murder and that of Georgette Borderoff, a socialite who was strangled to death in her West Hollywood home in 1944. Gilmore suggested Short's employment at the Hollywood Canteen, where Borderoff also worked as a hostess, could be a potential connection between the two women. However, the claim that Short ever worked at the Hollywood Canteen has been disputed by others, such as retired Times copy editor Larry Harnish. The 2017 book, Black Dahlia, Red Rose by Pooh Eatwell, focuses on Leslie Dillon, a bellhop who was a former mortician's assistant, his associates Mark Hansen and Jeff Connors, and Sergeant Phineas Brown, the lead detective who had links to Hansen and was allegedly corrupt. Eatwell posts that Short was murdered because she knew too much about the men's involvement in a scheme for robbing hotels. She further suggests that Short was killed at the Astor Motel in Los Angeles, where the owners reported finding one of their rooms covered in blood and fecal matter on the morning Short's body was found. The Examiner stated in 1949 that L.A. Police Chief William A. Wharton denied that the Flower Street Motel had anything to do with the case, although its rival newspaper, the Los Angeles Herald, claimed that the murder took place there. Eatwell is working on a television documentary, and a revised edition of her book is due to be released in autumn. In 2000, Buzz Williams, a retired detective of the Long Beach Police Department, wrote an article for the LBPD newsletter, The Rap Sheet, on Short's murder. Williams' father, Richard F. Williams, and his friend, Con Keller, were both members of L.A.'s gangster squad investigating the case. Williams Sr. believed that Dillon was a killer, and that when Dillon returned to his home state of Oklahoma, he was able to avoid extradition to California because his ex-wife, Georgia Stevenson, was second cousins with Governor Adali Stevenson, the second of Illinois, who contacted the governor of Oklahoma on Dillon's behalf. Keller believed Hansen was the killer, and he had studied at the surgical school in Sweden and had thrown elaborate parties attended by prominent LAPD officials. Williams' article says that Dillon sued the LAPD for $3 million, but that suit was dropped. Harnish disputes this, claiming that Dillon was cleared by police after an exhaustive investigation and that the district attorney's files positively placed him in San Francisco when Short was killed. Harnish claims that there was no LAPD cover-up and that Dillon did in fact receive a financial settlement from the city of Los Angeles, but has not produced concrete evidence to prove this. So, yeah.
So, really, nobody knows shit.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that could have happened, in theory.
And what's crazy is that, like, there's so many books about this earth. There's so many books about everything.
Yeah.
That, like, the true story, what really happened.
And everyone's an expert.
Shit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that is not what really happened. But I do think whoever did it had to have had some kind of medical training, surgical training.
Yeah.
The mortician's assistant, I don't think, would really know enough.
You know, I do give credit to the,
you know, anatomy, but to be able to cut a body that way.
Like that. You mean that's
maybe the mortician, but not the assistant guy.
That's an art form right there. Come here, Clarice. Let me tell you more. Yeah. No, that really is, like, you would need some serious training on how to do that. I do give credit to the woman who in 1995, though, came out with the paperback that it was like the Black Dahlia murderer was my daddy or something. Because I'm just guessing, she probably made a few appearances on places like Sally Jesse and Donahue and Maury.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Because that would just have been like, oh, up next. Was her father the murderer of the Black Dahlia? We'll find out right after we send these kids to prison camp next on Maury. You know,
exactly.
Something like that. I always love the solicitations where it's like, do you suspect that a member of your family may have murdered the Black Dahlia in 1947? If so, we want to hear from you. Yeah. And did they also have sex with your pets?
I don't even know if Maury's still on, but it was just, all it was baby daddies.
Yeah.
Every episode. Found something that worked.
And they should have just called it the Baby Daddy Show. I don't know if he's still on or not. There's like an app on Hulu or something and it's all 1990s talk shows and 80s talk shows. It is glorious. If you ever want to, I forget what it's called. Nosy, I think, maybe. This is not a sponsorship or anything. I found it and I found it amusing. But you can watch Sally Jesse. You can watch old Springer. You can watch anything you want from that era. And it is hilarious to watch. It's a great escape from the world today. And it's funny because that's the shit that we would, you know, if that would be on television in like 1991, like, what is that crap you're watching? Now it's like, oh, breath of fresh fucking air. Come here, Sally Jesse.
Oh, back when the world was normal.
Put on those giant fucking glasses and talk to us about some sort of crazy shit. You know? When that was the worst of our problems. Let's go into some of the details here regarding Short's death and reported and factual disputes, just to make this just slightly more confusing than it already is. Numerous details regarding Short's personal life and death have been points of public dispute. The eager involvement of both the public and press in solving her murder have been credited as factors that complicated the investigation significantly, resulting in a complex, sometimes inconsistent narrative of events. According to Anne-Marie DiStefano of the Portland Tribune, many unsubstantiated stories have circulated about Short over the years. She was a prostitute, she was frigid, she was pregnant, she was a lesbian, and somehow, instead of fading away over time, the legend of the Black Dahlia just keeps getting more convoluted. Harnish had refuted several supposed rumors and popular conceptions about Short and her murder, and also disputed the validity of Gilmore's book Severed, claiming the book is 25% mistakes and 50% fiction. Harnish also had examined the district attorney's files. He claimed that Steve Hodell examined some of them pertaining to his father, along with Times columnist Steve Lopez. And contrary to Eatwell's claims, the files show that Dylan was thoroughly investigated and was determined to have been in San Francisco when Short was killed. Harnish speculated that Eatwell either did not find these files or she chose to ignore them. A number of people, none of which who knew Short, contacted police and the newspapers and claimed to have seen her during her so-called missing week between her January 9th disappearance and the discovery of her body on January 15th. Police and DA investigators ruled out each alleged sighting. In some cases, those interviewed were identifying other women who they had mistaken for Short. Short's whereabouts in the days leading up to her murder and the discovery of her body are still unknown. After the discovery of Short's body, numerous Los Angeles newspapers printed headlines claiming she had been tortured leading up to her death. This was denied by law enforcement at the time, but they allowed the claims to circulate as to keep Short's actual cause of death a secret from the public. Some sources, such as Oliver Cyrex's Crime and Encyclopedia, state that Short's body was covered in cigarette burns inflicted on her while she was still alive, though there is no indication of this in her official autopsy report. In Severed, Gilmore states that the coroner performed Short's autopsy suggested in conversation that she had been forced to consume feces based on his findings when examining the contents of her stomach. This claim has been denied by Harnish and is also not indicated in Short's official autopsy, though it's been reprinted in several print and online media. So what it just keeps coming down to, people, I mean, you can almost add or say anything you want about this case, and if it gets a little traction, people will just keep repeating it, and in this day and age, it'll just keep going and going. There's no one around for the most part anymore to say, no, that wasn't true. That actually was there as a figure in the case. And all you have is really, the autopsy report to go, no, that's not in that report. Where the hell do you get that from? Who's there to talk and share any of this anymore?
And what's so crazy is, like, we were talking earlier about the 700 investigators.
Yeah.
So then on top of that, you have all of these people calling in various tips that really aren't tips. I saw her here. I saw her there. How would you even organize that?
I don't know.
How would you? It's not like you can just go open file, click on the tips folder, enter it. It's like. Yeah. It would just be a jumbled mess, which is why it ended up a jumbled mess.
It's one of those things where if this had happened today exactly as is, and we have the resources we do today from DNA testing to everything else, and just the speed at which information can travel, I
not
would
to mention cameras everywhere.
That too. I would think that the amount of work that got done on this case, which took years and years and years, would have been done in like 3 days. Just simply because of the time to corroborate the information like you're talking about and to just cross-reference everything. They could have crossed so many things off the list so much faster and moved that much more fast in terms of trying to find some true solid answers to who did this. But it ended up taking, there's never really been any finding as far as conclusively who did it, but it took many, many, many years for others to be able to put some pieces together to go, there's high odds in this person's direction, but A, they're already dead, or B, there's really no other pieces of evidence that we can piece together to corroborate that story either. But yeah, I mean, in the world of today, they could probably find the killer pretty damn quick, I would think. I mean,
or they might not have ever found the killer. I mean, that things like that happen every day as far as just so sad. I couldn't imagine. But I mean, because you think back then, not only they have 700 investigators and 1,000 tips coming in, but then they've got the freaking newspaper guys going to the families and lying to them and getting them to talk to them. And they fed into that whole thing too.
Yeah.
Because then they're just printing bullshit.
Yeah.
Just to be sensational about it and get more readers and sell more newspapers. So that's what they were in the business of.
Yeah.
Selling papers, not necessarily uncovering the truth. Because there was, like, at that time, that whole newspaper war was crazy.
It's interesting because when you think back on newspapers of that era, I mean, I wasn't around in that era. You weren't around in that era. But in my mind, I would think, I think more reliable. These are more real reporters. And I would imagine there's probably that sort of thing of the day where, like, this is the real, there's the New York Times and there's the New York Post. One is a rag, one is...
William Randolph Hearst?
Yeah.
That guy was ruthless.
Yeah.
He was ruthless and would take down anybody who would get in his way.
Company's still around today, isn't it?
I don't know if it still is or not.
Hearst Corporation? I think they still own stuff.
There's probably some variation of it anyway. Yeah, but back in the day, that guy. So, yeah. Who knows? And then in the meantime, all of the scandal and the intrigue and the stories, there's this poor woman's family, and she had friends, and she had a life, and no one will ever know what happened.
Yeah. They went right to what happens a lot today. Like, when you can't find the answer, well, then let's go to the shame world. And that's, yeah, it's, you know, as much as things change, there's many, many things that have not. And, you know, you see it from generation to generation. This is how they treated things back then. You know, then these people had kids, those people had kids, and slowly, you know, the shittiness hopefully wears away, but it certainly takes some time to not think like that. And some of it just seems so archaic. But if you look today, there's people who still think like that, and it's fucked up. But there you go. The Black Dahlia. It took Unsolved Mysteries, really, I think, to really revitalize the interest in it in, like, what was it, 91 or something? I remember that episode. That was a good episode. I think it's in the Ghost series, because I think it might have been about the Black Dahlia's ghost that allegedly haunts the hotel that she was murdered in. But yeah, I love that. This is not an advertisement for them either, but if you've not done it yet, you like our show. Unsolved Mysteries is back on Netflix. It's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I want to watch it. I haven't seen it yet.
I hate the subtitle ones, though. I mean, and it's like the ghost ones are good, but I like just at least do translation and not the Netflix translator. Like, I do it like you used to do, because there's a whole episode that is like, you need translation and I can't pay attention when I'm trying to work.
I watched that one.
Oh, of course.
It did not bother me. It was French.
There's one in Japanese that comes up.
I haven't seen that one.
But no, I did the French one with the translation on, and it helped. But the other one, it's a little more difficult to get through, just because there's a lot of describing scenery, and I don't care about the scenery. It's like, they say this, and then a large open waterway flows into the screen with blue flowing water. It's like, just totally ruins the screen, the whole thing. But anyway, it is a good series, and I like the tributes to Robert Stack in it as well. A big ghostly image right as the logo comes up. All right, that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our show, thank you. We appreciate that. Please, if you could, leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. Let other folks know that we exist. Helps us grow in the rankings and so forth. And do press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.